irresistible urge to blame others and to retaliate. How about you? Does the idea that many of your angry thoughts are invalid seem abhorrent and unacceptable? The empathy technique can also be quite useful when the other person's actions appear more obviously and intentionally hurtful. A 28-year-old woman named Melissa sought counseling around the time she was separating from her husband, Howard. 5 years earlier, Melissa discovered that Howard was having an affair with Anne, an attractive secretary who worked in his building. The revelation was a heavy blow to Melissa, but to make matters even worse, Howard was hesitant to make a clean break with Anne, and so the affair dragged on for 8 additional months. The humiliation and rage Melissa felt during this period was a major factor that led to her ultimate decision to leave him. Her thoughts ran along these lines. 1, he had no right to act like that. 2, he was self-centered. 3, it was unfair. 4, he was a bad, rotten person. 5, I must have failed. In the course of a therapy session, I asked Melissa to play Howard's role, and then I cross-examined her to see if she could explain precisely why he had had the affair with Anne and acted as he did. She reported that as the role-playing evolved, she suddenly saw where Howard had been coming from, and at that moment, her anger toward him completely vanished. After the session, she wrote a description of the dramatic disappearance of the anger she had harbored for years. After Howard's affair with Anne presumably ended, he insisted on continuing to see her and was still very much bound up with her. This was painful to me. It made me feel that Howard really didn't respect me and considered himself more important than I was. I felt that if he really did love me, he wouldn't put me through this. How could he continue to see Anne when he knew how miserable it made me feel? I felt really angry at Howard and down on myself. When I tried the empathy approach and played the role of Howard, I saw the whole. I suddenly saw things differently. When I imagined I was Howard, I could see where he was coming from. Putting myself in his place, I saw the problem of loving Melissa, my wife, as well as Anne, my lover. It dawned on me that Howard was really trapped in a can't-win system created by his thoughts and feelings. He loved me, but was desperately attracted to Anne. As much as he wanted to, he couldn't stop seeing her. He felt very guilty and couldn't stop himself. He felt he would lose if he left Anne, and he would lose if he left me. He was unwilling and unable to come to terms with either form of loss, and it was his indecisiveness, rather than any inadequacy on my part, which caused him to be slow in making up his mind. The experience was a revelation for me. I really saw what had happened for the first time. I knew Howard had not done anything deliberately to hurt me, but had been incapable of doing anything other than what he did. I felt good being able to see and understand this. I told Howard when I spoke to him next. We both felt a lot better about this. I also got a really good feeling from the experience with the empathy technique. It was very exciting, more real than what I had seen before. The key to Melissa's anger was her fear of losing self-esteem. Although Howard had indeed acted in a genuinely negative manner, it was the meaning she attached to the experience that caused her sense of grief and rage. She assumed that as a good wife, she was entitled to a good marriage. This is the logic that got her into emotional trouble. Premise: if I am a good and adequate wife, my husband is bound to love me and be faithful to me. Observation: my husband is not acting in a loving, faithful way. Conclusion: therefore, either I am not a good and adequate wife, or else Howard is a bad, immoral person because he is breaking my rule. Thus, Melissa's anger represented a feeble attempt to save the day because, within her system of assumptions, this was actually the only alternative to suffering a loss of self-esteem. The only problems with her solution were, A, she wasn't really convinced he was no good, B, she didn't really want to write him off since she loved him, and C, her chronic sour anger didn't feel good, it didn't look good, and it drove him farther away. Her premise that he would love her as long as she was good was a fairy tale she had never thought to question. The empathy method transformed her thinking in a highly beneficial way by allowing her to relinquish the grandiosity inherent in her premise. His misbehavior was caused by his distorted cognitions, not her inadequacy. Thus, he was responsible for the jam he was in, not she. This sudden insight struck her like a lightning bolt. The moment she saw the world through his eyes, her anger vanished. she became a much smaller person in the sense that she no longer saw herself as responsible for the actions of her husband and the people around her. But at the same time, she experienced a sudden increase in self-esteem. In the next session, I decided to put her new insight to the acid test. I confronted her with the negative thoughts that had originally upset her to see if she could answer them effectively. David. Howard could have stopped seeing her sooner. He made a fool out of you. Melissa. No, he couldn't stop because he was trapped. He felt a tremendous obsession, and he was attracted to Anne. But then he should have gone off with her and broken up with you so he could stop torturing you. That would have been the only decent thing to do. He felt he couldn't break it off with me either because he loved me and was committed to me and to our children. But that was unfair to keep you dangling so long. He didn't mean to be unfair. It just happened. It just happened? What Pollyanna nonsense. The fact is, he shouldn't have gotten into such a situation in the first place. But that's where he was at. Anne represented excitement, and he felt bored and overwhelmed by life at the time. Eventually, one day, he just couldn't resist her flirting anymore. He took one small step over the line in a moment of weakness, and then the affair was off and running. Well, you are less of a person because he wasn't faithful to you. This makes you inferior. It has nothing to do with being less of a person. I don't have to get what I want all the time to be worthwhile. But he never would have sought excitement elsewhere if you were an adequate wife. You're undesirable and unlovable. You're second rate, and that's why your husband had an affair. The fact is, he ultimately chose me over Anne, but that doesn't make me any better than Anne, does it? Similarly, the fact that he chose to deal with his problems by escaping doesn't mean that I'm unlovable or less desirable. I could see that Melissa was clearly unruffled by my vigorous attempts to get her goat, and this proved she had transcended this painful period of her life. She traded in her anger for joy and self-esteem. Empathy was the key that freed her from being trapped in hostility, self-doubt, and despair. Putting it all together, cognitive rehearsal. When you get angry, you may feel you react too rapidly to be able to sit down and assess the situation objectively and apply the various techniques described in this chapter. This is one of the characteristics of anger. Unlike depression, which tends to be steady and chronic, anger is much more eruptive and episodic. By the time you are aware you are upset, you may already feel out of control. Cognitive rehearsal is an effective method for solving this problem and for synthesizing and using the tools you have learned thus far. This technique will help you learn to overcome your anger ahead of time without actually experiencing the situation. Then when the real thing happens, you'll be prepared to handle it. Begin by listing an anger hierarchy of the situations that most commonly trigger you off and rank these from +1, the least upsetting, to +10, the most infuriating, as shown in Figure 7-7 on the enhancement. The provocations should be ones that you'd like to handle more effectively because your anger is maladaptive and undesirable. Start with the first item on the hierarchy list that is the least upsetting to you, and fantasize as vividly as you can that you are in that situation. Then verbalize your hot thoughts and write them down. In the example given in Figure 7-7, you're feeling annoyed because you're telling yourself, "The goddamn mother blanking waiters don't know what the blank they're doing. Why don't the lazy bastards get off their butts and move? Who the hell do they think they are? Am I supposed to starve to death before they'll give me a menu and a glass of water?" Next, fantasize flying off the handle, telling off the maitre d', and storming out and slamming the restaurant door. Now record how upset you feel between 0 and 100%. Then go through the same mental scenario, but substitute more appropriate, cool thoughts and fantasize that you feel relaxed and unperturbed. Imagine that you handle the situation tactfully, assertively, and effectively. For example, you might tell yourself, "The waiters don't seem to be noticing me. Perhaps they're busy and overlook the fact that I haven't gotten a menu yet. No point in getting hot under the collar about this." Then instruct yourself to approach the head waiter and explain the situation assertively, following these principles. Point out tactfully that you've been waiting. If he explains they are busy, disarm him by agreeing with him. Compliment him on the good business they are doing and repeat your request for better service in a firm but friendly way. Finally, imagine that he responds by sending a waiter who apologizes and gives you top-notch VIP service. You feel good and enjoy the meal. Now practice going through this version of the scenario each night until you have mastered it and can fantasize handling the situation effectively and calmly in this manner. This cognitive rehearsal will enable you to program yourself to respond in a more assertive and relaxed way when the actual situation confronts you again. You might have one objection to this procedure. You may feel it is unrealistic to fantasize a positive outcome in the restaurant since there is no guarantee the staff will, in reality, respond in a friendly way and give you what you want. The answer to this objection is simple. There's no guarantee they'll respond abrasively either, but if you expect a negative response, you'll enhance the probability of getting one because your anger will have an enormous capacity to act as a self-fulfilling prophecy. In contrast, if you expect and fantasize a positive outcome and apply an upbeat approach, it will be much more likely to occur. You can, of course, also prepare for a negative outcome in a similar way using the cognitive rehearsal method. Imagine you do approach the waiter and he acts snotty and superior and gives you poor service. Now, record your hot thoughts, then substitute cool thoughts and develop a new coping strategy as you did before. You can continue to work your way up your hierarchy list in this way until you have learned to think, feel, and act more peacefully and effectively in the majority of the provocative situations you encounter. Your approach to these situations will have to be flexible, and different coping techniques may be required for the different types of provocations listed. Empathy might be the answer in one situation. Verbal assertiveness could be the key to another. And changing your expectations might be the most useful approach to a third. It will be crucial not to evaluate your progress in your anger reduction program in an all-or-nothing way because emotional growth takes some time, especially when it comes to anger. If you ordinarily react to a particular provocation with 99% anger and then find you become 70% upset next time, you could view this as a successful first try. Now keep working at it, using your cognitive rehearsal method, and see if you can reduce it to 50%, and then to 30%. Eventually, you will make it vanish altogether, or at least you will have brought it down to an acceptable, irreducible minimum. Remember that the wisdom of friends and associates can be a potential gold mine you can utilize when you're stuck. They may see clearly in any area where you have a blind spot. Ask them how they think, and behave in a particular situation that makes you feel frustrated, helpless, and enraged. What would they tell themselves? What would they actually do? You can learn a surprising amount rapidly if you're willing to ask. 10 things you should know about your anger. 1. The events of this world don't make you angry. Your hot thoughts create your anger, even when a genuinely negative event occurs. It is the meaning you attach to it that determines your emotional response. The idea that you are responsible for your anger is ultimately to your advantage because it gives you the opportunity to achieve control and make a free choice about how you want to feel. If it weren't for this, you would be helpless to control your emotions. They would be irreversibly bound up with every external event of this world, most of which are ultimately out of your control. 2. Most of the time your anger will not help you. It will immobilize you, and you will become frozen in your hostility to no productive purpose. You will feel better if you place your emphasis on the active search for creative solutions. What can you do to correct the difficulty or at least reduce the chance that you'll get burned in the same way in the future? This attitude will eliminate to a certain extent the helplessness and frustration that eat you up when you feel you can't deal with a situation effectively. If no solution is possible because the provocation is totally beyond your control, you will only make yourself miserable with your resentment. So why not get rid of it? It's difficult, if not impossible, to feel anger and joy simultaneously. If you think your angry feelings are especially precious and important, then think about one of the happiest moments of your life. Now ask yourself, how many minutes of that period of peace or jubilation would I be willing to trade in for feeling frustration and irritation instead? 3. The thoughts that generate anger more often than not will contain distortions. Correcting these distortions will reduce your anger. 4. Ultimately, your anger is caused by your belief that someone is acting unfairly or some event is unjust. The intensity of the anger will increase in proportion to the severity of the maliciousness perceived, and if the act is seen as intentional. 5. If you learn to see the world through other people's eyes, you will often be surprised to realize their actions are not unfair from their point of view. The unfairness in these cases turns out to be an illusion that exists only in your mind. If you are willing to let go of the unrealistic notion that your concepts of truth, justice, and fairness are shared by everyone, much of your resentment and frustration will vanish. 6. Other people usually do not feel they deserve your punishment. Therefore, your retaliation is unlikely to help you achieve any positive goals in your interactions with them. Your rage will often just cause further deterioration and polarization and will function as a self-fulfilling prophecy. Even if you temporarily get what you want, any short-term gains from such hostile manipulation will often be more than counterbalanced by a long-term resentment and retaliation from the people you are coercing. No one likes to be controlled or forced. This is why a positive reward system works better. 7. A great deal of your anger involves your defense against loss of self-esteem when people criticize you, disagree with you, or fail to behave as you want them to. Such anger is always inappropriate, because only your own negative distorted thoughts can cause you to lose self-esteem. When you blame the other guy for your feelings of worthlessness, you are always fooling yourself. 8. Frustration results from unmet expectations. Since the event that disappointed you was a part of reality, it was realistic. Thus, your frustration always results from your unrealistic expectation. You have the right to try to influence reality to bring it more in line with your expectations, but this is not always practical, especially when these expectations represent ideals that don't correspond to everyone else's concept of human nature. The simplest solution would be to change your expectations. For example, some unrealistic expectations that lead to frustration include: A. If I want something, love, happiness, a promotion, etc., I deserve it. B. If I work hard at something, I should be successful. C. Other people should try to measure up to my standards and believe in my concept of fairness. D. I should be able to solve any problems quickly and easily. E. If I'm a good wife, my husband is bound to love me. F. People should think and act the way I do. G. If I'm nice to someone, they should reciprocate. 9. It is just childish pouting to insist you have the right to be angry. Of course you do. Anger is legally permitted in the United States. The crucial issue is it to your advantage to feel angry? Will you or the world really benefit from your rage? 10. You rarely need your anger in order to be human. It is not true that you will be an unfeeling robot without it. In fact, when you rid yourself of that sour irritability, you will feel greater zest, joy, peace, and productivity. You will experience liberation and enlightenment. Chapter 8. Ways of Defeating Guilt. No book on depression would be complete without a chapter on guilt. What is the function of guilt? Writers, spiritual leaders, psychologists, and philosophers have grappled forever with this question. What is the basis of guilt? Does it evolve from the concept of original sin, or from Oedipal incestuous fantasies and the other taboos that Freud postulated? Is it a realistic and helpful component of human experience? Or is it a useless emotion that mankind would be better off without, as suggested by some recent pop psychology writers? When the mathematics of calculus was developed, scientists found they could readily solve complex problems of motion and acceleration that were extremely difficult to handle using older methods. The cognitive theory has similarly provided us with a kind of emotional calculus that makes certain thorny philosophical and psychological questions much easier to resolve. Let's see what we can learn from a cognitive approach. Guilt is the emotion you will experience when you have the following thoughts. 1. I have done something I shouldn't have, or I have failed to do something I should have, because my actions fall short of my moral standards and violate my concept of fairness. 2. This bad behavior shows that I'm a bad person, or that I have an evil streak, or a tainted character, or a rotten core, etc. This concept of the badness of self is central to guilt. In its absence, your hurtful action might lead to a healthy feeling of remorse, but not guilt. Remorse stems from the undistorted awareness that you have willfully and unnecessarily acted in a hurtful manner toward yourself or another person that violates your personal ethical standards. Remorse differs from guilt because there is no implication your transgression indicates you are inherently bad, evil, or immoral. To put it in a nutshell, remorse or regret are aimed at behavior, whereas guilt is targeted toward the self. If in addition to your guilt, you feel depression, shame, or anxiety, you are probably making one of the following assumptions. 1. Because of my bad behavior, I am inferior or worthless. This interpretation leads to depression. 2. If others found out what I did, they would look down on me. This cognition leads to shame. 3. I'm in danger of retaliation or punishment. This thought provokes anxiety. The simplest way to assess whether the feelings created by such thoughts are useful or destructive is to determine if they contain any of the 10 cognitive distortions described in Chapter 3. To the extent that these thinking errors are present, your guilt, anxiety, depression, or shame certainly cannot be valid or realistic. I suspect you will find that a great many of your negative feelings are in fact based on such thinking errors. The first potential distortion when you are feeling guilty is your assumption you have done something wrong. This may or may not actually be the case. Is the behavior you condemn in yourself in reality so terrible, immoral, or wrong? Or are you magnifying things out of proportion? A charming medical technologist recently brought me a sealed envelope containing a piece of paper on which she had written something about herself which was so terrible she couldn't bear to say it out loud. As she, trembling, handed the envelope to me, she made me promise not to read it out loud or laugh at her. The message inside was, "I pick my nose and eat it." The apprehension and horror on her face in contrast to the triviality of what she had written struck me as so funny, I lost all professional composure and burst into laughter. Fortunately, she too broke into a belly laugh and expressed a sense of relief. Am I claiming that you never behave badly? No. That position would be extreme and unrealistic. I am simply insisting that to the extent your perception of goofing up is unrealistically magnified, your anguish and self-persecution are inappropriate and unnecessary. A second key distortion that leads to guilt is when you label yourself a bad person because of what you did. This is actually the kind of superstitious, destructive thinking that led to the medieval witch hunts. You may have engaged in a bad, angry, hurtful action, but it is counterproductive to label yourself a bad or rotten person because your energy gets channeled into rumination and self-persecution instead of creative problem-solving strategies. Another common guilt-provoking distortion is personalization. You inappropriately assume responsibility for an event you did not cause. Suppose you offer a constructive criticism to your boyfriend, who reacts in a defensive and hurt manner. You may blame yourself for his emotional upset and arbitrarily conclude that your comment was inappropriate. In fact, his negative thoughts upset him, not your comment. Furthermore, these thoughts are probably distorted. He might be thinking that your criticism means he's no good and conclude that you don't respect him. Now, did you put that illogical thought into his head? Obviously not. He did it, so you can't assume responsibility for his reaction. Because cognitive therapy asserts that only your thoughts create your feelings, you might come to the nihilistic belief that you cannot hurt anybody no matter what you do, and hence you have license to do anything. After all, why not run out on your family, cheat on your wife, and screw your partner financially? If they're upset, it's their problem because it's their thoughts, right? Wrong. Here we come again to the importance of the concept of cognitive distortion. To the extent that a person's emotional upset is caused by his distorted thoughts, then you can say he is responsible for his suffering. If you blame yourself for that individual's pain, it is a personalization error. In contrast, if a person's suffering is caused by valid, undistorted thoughts, then the suffering is real and may in fact have an external cause. For example, you might kick me in the stomach and I could have the thoughts, "I've been kicked, it hurts." In this case, the responsibility for my pain rests with you, and your perception that you have hurt me is not distorted in any way. Your remorse and my discomfort are real and valid. Inappropriate should statements represent the final common pathway to your guilt. Irrational should statements imply you are expected to be perfect, all-knowing, or all-powerful. Perfectionistic shoulds include rules for living that defeat you by creating impossible expectations and rigidity. One example of this would be, I should be happy at all times. The consequence of this rule is that you will feel like a failure every time you are upset. Since it is obviously unrealistic for any human being to achieve the goal of perpetual happiness, the rule is self-defeating and irresponsible. A should statement that is based on the premise you are all-knowing assumes you have all the knowledge in the universe and that you can predict the future with absolute certainty. For example, you might think, I shouldn't have gone to the beach this weekend because I was coming down with the flu. What a jerk I am. Now I'm so sick I'll be in bed for a week. Berating yourself this way is unrealistic because you didn't know for certain that going to the beach would make you so ill. If you had known this, you would have acted differently. Being human, you made a decision, and your hunch turned out to be wrong. Should statements based on the premise you are all-powerful assume that, like God, you are omnipotent and have the ability to control yourself and other people so as to achieve each and every goal? You miss your tennis serve and wince, exclaiming, I shouldn't have missed that serve. Why shouldn't you? Is your tennis so superb that you can't possibly miss a serve? It is clear that these three categories of should statements create an inappropriate sense of guilt because they do not represent sensible moral standards. In addition to distortion, several other criteria can be helpful in distinguishing abnormal guilt from a healthy sense of remorse or regret. These include the intensity, duration, and consequences of your negative emotion. Let's use these criteria to evaluate the incapacitating guilt of a married 52-year-old grammar school teacher named Janice. Janice had been severely depressed for many years. Her problem was that she continually obsessed about two episodes of shoplifting that had occurred when she was 15. Although she had led a scrupulously honest life since that time, she could not shake the memory of those two incidents. Guilt-provoking thoughts constantly plagued her. I'm a thief, I'm a liar, I'm no good, I'm a fake. The agony of her guilt was so enormous that every night she prayed that God would let her die in her sleep. Every morning when she woke up, still alive, she was bitterly disappointed and told herself, I'm such a bad person, even God doesn't want me. In frustration, she finally loaded her husband's pistol, aimed it at her heart, and pulled the trigger. The gun misfired and did not go off. She had not cocked it properly. She felt the ultimate defeat. She couldn't even kill herself. She put the gun down and wept in despair. Janice's guilt is inappropriate not only because of the obvious distortions, but also because of the intensity, duration, and consequences of what she was feeling and telling herself. What she feels cannot be described as a healthy remorse or regret about the actual shoplifting, but an irresponsible degradation of her self-esteem that blinds her to living in the here and now, and is far out of proportion to any actual transgression. The consequences of her guilt created the ultimate irony. Her belief that she was a bad person caused her to attempt to murder herself, a most destructive and pointless act. The guilt cycle. Even if your guilt is unhealthy and based on distortion, once you begin to feel guilty, you may become trapped in an illusion that makes the guilt appear valid. Such illusions can be powerful and convincing. You reason, one, I feel guilty and worthy of condemnation. This means I've been bad. Two, since I'm bad, I deserve to suffer. Thus, your guilt convinces you of your badness and leads to further guilt. This cognitive emotional connection locks your thoughts and feelings into each other. You end up trapped in a circular system, which I call the guilt cycle. Emotional reasoning fuels this cycle. You automatically assume that because you're feeling guilty, you must have fallen short in some way and that you deserve to suffer. You reason, I feel bad, therefore I must be bad. This is irrational because your self-loathing does not necessarily prove that you did anything wrong. Your guilt just reflects the fact that you believe you behaved badly. This might be the case, but it often is not. For example, children are frequently punished inappropriately when parents are feeling tired and irritable and misinterpret their behavior. Under these conditions, the poor child's guilt obviously does not prove he or she did anything wrong. Your self-punishing behavior patterns intensify the guilt cycle. Your guilt-provoking thoughts lead to unproductive actions that reinforce your belief in your badness. For example, a guilt-prone neurologist was trying to prepare for her medical board certification examination. She had difficulty studying for the test and felt guilty about the fact that she wasn't studying. So she wasted time each night watching television while the following thoughts raced through her mind. I shouldn't be watching TV. I should be preparing for my boards. I'm lazy. I don't deserve to be a doctor. I'm too self-centered. I ought to be punished. These thoughts made her feel intensely guilty. She then reasoned, this guilt proves what a lazy, no-good person I am. Thus, her self-punishing thoughts and her guilty feelings reinforced each other. Like many guilt-prone people, she had the idea that if she punished herself enough, she would eventually get moving. Unfortunately, quite the opposite was true. Her guilt simply drained her energy and reinforced her belief that she was lazy and inadequate. The only actions that resulted from her self-loathing were the nightly compulsive trips to the refrigerator to pig out on ice cream or peanut butter. The vicious cycle that she trapped herself in is shown on the enhancement in Figure 8.1. Her negative thoughts, feelings, and behaviors all interacted in the creation of the self-defeating, cruel illusion that she was bad and uncontrollable. The irresponsibility of guilt. If you have actually done something inappropriate or hurtful, does it follow that you deserve to suffer? If you feel the answer to this question is yes, then ask yourself, how long must I suffer? One day? A year? For the rest of my life? What sentence will you choose to impose on yourself? Are you willing to stop suffering and making yourself miserable when your sentence has expired? This would at least be a responsible way to punish yourself because it would be time-limited. But what is the point of abusing yourself with guilt in the first place? If you did make a mistake and act in a hurtful way, your guilt won't reverse your blunder in some magical manner. It won't speed your learning processes so as to reduce the chance you'll make the same mistake in the future. Other people won't love and respect you more because you were feeling guilty and putting yourself down in this manner. Nor will your guilt lead to productive living. So what's the point? Many people ask, but how could I behave morally and control my impulses if I don't feel guilt? This is the probation officer approach to living. Apparently, you view yourself as so willful and uncontrollable that you must constantly castigate yourself in order to keep from going wild. Certainly, if your behavior has a needlessly hurtful impact on others, a small amount of painful remorse will add to your awareness more effectively than a sterile recognition of your goof-up with no emotional arousal. But it certainly never helped anyone to view himself as a bad person. More often than not, the belief that you are bad contributes to the bad behavior. Change and learning occur most readily when you, A, recognize that an error has occurred, and B, develop a strategy for correcting the problem. An attitude of self-love and relaxation facilitates this, whereas guilt often interferes. For example, occasionally patients criticize me for making a sharp comment that rubs them the wrong way. This criticism usually only hurts my feelings and arouses my guilt if it contains a grain of truth. To the extent that I feel guilty and label myself as bad, I tend to react defensively. I have the urge to either deny or justify my error, or to counterattack because that feeling of being a bad person is so odious. This makes it much more difficult for me to admit and correct the error. If, in contrast, I do not harangue myself or experience any loss of self-respect, it is easy to admit my mistake. Then I can readily correct the problem and learn from it. The less guilt I have, the more effectively I can do this. Thus, what is called for when you do goof up is a process of recognition, learning, and change. Does guilt help you with any of these? I don't believe it does. Rather than facilitating your recognition of your error, guilt engages you in a cover-up operation. You want to close your ears to any criticism. You can't bear to be in the wrong because it feels so terrible. This is why guilt is counterproductive. You may protest, how can I know I've done something wrong if I don't feel guilty? Wouldn't I just indulge in a blind rampage of uncontrolled, destructive selfishness if it weren't for my guilt? Anything is possible, but I honestly doubt this would happen. You can replace your guilt with a more enlightened basis for moral behavior. Empathy. Empathy is the ability to visualize the consequences, good and bad, of your behavior. Empathy is the capacity to conceptualize the impact of what you do on yourself and on the other person, and to feel appropriate and genuine sorrow and regret without labeling yourself as inherently bad. Empathy gives you the necessary mental and emotional climate to guide your behavior in a moral and self-enhancing manner in the absence of the whip of guilt. Using these criteria, you can now readily determine whether your feelings represent a normal and healthy sense of remorse or a self-defeating, distorted sense of guilt. Ask yourself, 1. Did I consciously and willfully do something bad, unfair, or needlessly hurtful that I shouldn't have? Or am I irrationally expecting myself to be perfect, all-knowing, or all-powerful? 2. Am I labeling myself a bad or tainted person because of this action? Do my thoughts contain other cognitive distortions, such as magnification, overgeneralization, etc.? 3. Am I feeling a realistic regret or remorse, which results from an empathetic awareness of the negative impact of my action? Are the intensity and duration of my painful emotional response appropriate to what I actually did? 4. Am I learning from my error and developing a strategy for change? Or am I moping and ruminating non-productively or even punishing myself in a destructive manner? Now let's review some methods that will allow you to rid yourself of inappropriate guilty feelings and maximize your self-respect. 1. Daily record of dysfunctional thoughts. In earlier chapters, you were introduced to a daily record of dysfunctional thoughts for overcoming low self-esteem and inadequacy. This method works handsomely for a variety of unwanted emotions, including guilt. Record the activating event that leads to your guilt in the column labeled Situation. You may write, I spoke sharply to an associate, or instead of contributing $10, I threw my alumni fundraising appeal in the wastebasket. Then tune in to that tyrannical loudspeaker in your head and identify the accusations that create your guilt. Finally, identify the distortions and write down more objective thoughts. This leads to relief. An example of this is demonstrated in Figure 8-2, as shown on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. Shirley was a high-strung young woman who decided to move to New York to pursue her acting career. After she and her mother had spent a long and tiring day looking for apartments, they took a train back to Philadelphia. After boarding, they discovered they had mistakenly taken a train without food service or a lounge car. Shirley's mother began to complain about the lack of cocktail service, and Shirley felt flooded with guilt and self-criticism. As she recorded and talked back to her guilt-provoking thoughts, she felt substantial relief. She told me that by overcoming her guilt, she avoided the temper tantrum she would normally have thrown in such a frustrating situation. See Figure 8-2 from the enhanced portion of the audiobook. 2. Should removal techniques. Here are some methods for reducing all those irrational should statements you've been hitting yourself with. The first is to ask yourself, who says I should? Where is it written that I should? The point of this is to make you aware that you are being critical of yourself unnecessarily. Since you are ultimately making your own rules, once you decide that a rule is not useful, you can revise it or get rid of it. Suppose you were telling yourself that you should be able to make your spouse happy all the time. If your experience teaches you that this is neither realistic nor helpful, you can rewrite the rule to make it more valid. You might say, I can make my spouse happy some of the time, but I certainly can't at all times. Ultimately, happiness is up to him or her, and I'm not perfect any more than he or she is. Therefore, I will not anticipate that what I do will always be appreciated. In deciding about the usefulness of a particular rule, it can be helpful to ask yourself, what are the advantages and disadvantages of having that rule for myself? How will it help me believe I should always be able to make my spouse happy? And what will the price be for believing this? You can assess the costs and benefits using the double column method shown on the enhancement in Figure 8-3. Another simple but effective way to rid yourself of should statements involves substituting other words for should using the double column technique. The terms, it would be nice if, or I wish I could, work well and often sound more realistic and less upsetting. For example, instead of saying, I should be able to make my wife happy, you could substitute, it would be nice if I could make my wife happy now because she seems upset. I can ask what she's upset about and see if there might be a way I could help. Or instead of, I shouldn't have eaten the ice cream, you can say, it would have been better if I hadn't eaten the ice cream, but it's not the end of the world that I did. Another anti-should method involves showing yourself that a should statement doesn't fit reality. For example, when you say, I shouldn't have done X, you assume, one, it is a fact that you shouldn't have, and two, it is going to help you to say this. The reality method reveals, to your surprise, that the truth is usually just the opposite. A, in point of fact, you should have done what you did, and B, it is going to hurt you to say you shouldn't have. Incredulous? Let me demonstrate. Assume you've been trying to diet and you ate some ice cream. So you have the thought, I shouldn't have eaten this ice cream. In our dialogue, I want you to argue that it's really true that you shouldn't have eaten the ice cream, and I will try to put the lie to your arguments. The following is modeled after an actual conversation, which I hope you find as delightful and helpful as I did. David, I understand you're on a diet and you ate some ice cream. I believe you should have eaten the ice cream. You, oh no, that's impossible. I shouldn't have eaten it because I'm on a diet. You see, I'm trying to lose weight. Well, I believe you should have eaten the ice cream. Burns, are you dense? I shouldn't have because I'm trying to lose weight. That's what I'm trying to tell you. How can I lose weight if I'm eating ice cream? But in point of fact, you did eat it. Yeah, that's the problem. I shouldn't have done that. Now do you see the light? And apparently you're claiming that things should have been different than they were. But things were the way they were, and things usually are the way they are, for a good reason. Why do you think you did what you did? What's the reason you ate the ice cream? Well, I was upset and I was nervous, and I'm basically a pig. Okay, you were upset and you were nervous. Have you had a pattern in your life of eating when you've been upset and nervous? Yeah, right. I've never had any self-control. So, wouldn't it be natural to expect, then, that last week when you were nervous, you would do what you have habitually done? Yeah. So, wouldn't it be sensible, therefore, to conclude that you should have done that because you had a very long-standing habit of doing it? I feel like you're telling me that I should just keep eating ice cream and end up like a fat pig or something. Most of my clients aren't as difficult as you. At any rate, I'm not telling you to act like a pig, and I'm not recommending you continue this bad habit of eating when you're upset. What I'm saying is that you're giving yourself two problems for the price of one. One is that you did in fact break your diet. If you're going to lose weight, this will slow you down. And the second problem is that you're being hard on yourself about having done that. The second headache, you don't need. So you're saying that because I have a habit of eating when I'm nervous, it's predictable that until I learn some methods for changing the habit, I'll continue to do it? I wish I'd said it that well myself. Therefore, I should have eaten the ice cream because I haven't changed the habit yet. As long as the habit continues, I will and should keep overeating when I'm nervous. I see what you mean. I feel a whole lot better, doctor, except for one thing. How can I learn to stop doing this? How can I develop some strategies for modifying my behavior in a more productive way? You can motivate yourself with a whip or a carrot. When you tell yourself, I should do this or I shouldn't do that all day long, you get bogged down with a shouldy approach to life. And you already know what you end up with, emotional constipation. If you'd rather get things moving instead, I suggest you try to motivate yourself through rewards rather than punishment. You might find that these work more effectively. In my case, I use the Dots and Donuts diet. Mason Dots, a gum candy, and glazed donuts are two of my favorite sweets. I found that the most difficult time to control my eating was in the evening when I was studying or watching TV. I'd have an urge to eat ice cream, so I told myself that if I controlled this urge, I could reward myself with a big fresh glazed donut in the morning and a box of Mason Dots in the evening. Then I'd concentrate on how good they'd taste, and this helped me forget the ice cream. Incidentally, I also had the rule that if I did goof up and eat the ice cream, I could still have the dots and the donut as a reward for trying or as a commiseration for slipping back. Either way, it helped me, and I lost over 50 pounds this way. I also made up the following syllogism. A. Human beings on diets goof up from time to time. B. I'm a human being. C. Therefore, I should goof up from time to time. This helped me greatly, too, and it enabled me to binge on weekends and feel good about it. I usually lost more during the week than I gained on weekends, so overall I lost weight and enjoyed myself. Every time I goofed up in my diet, I didn't allow myself to criticize the lapse or feel guilty. I began to think about it as the binge on whatever you want, whenever you want to, without guilt and enjoy it diet. And it was so much fun, it was a mild disappointment when I finally achieved my aimed-for weight. I actually lost over 10 more pounds at that point because the diet was so enjoyable. I believe that the proper attitude and feelings are the key. With them, you can move mountains, even mountains of flesh. The major thing that holds you back when you're trying to change a bad habit like eating, smoking, or drinking too much is your belief you are out of control. The cause of this lack of control is those should statements. They defeat you. Suppose, for example, you are trying to avoid eating ice cream. There you are watching TV saying, "Oh, I really should study and I shouldn't eat any ice cream." Now ask yourself, how do I feel when I say these things to myself? I think you know the answer. You feel guilty and nervous. Then what do? You go and eat. That is the point. The reason you're eating is that you're telling yourself you shouldn't. Then you try to bury your guilt and anxiety under more piles of food. Another simple should removal technique involves your wrist counter. Once you become convinced that the shoulds are not to your advantage, you can count them. Every time you make a should statement, click the counter. If you do this, be sure to set up a reward system based on the daily total. The more shoulds you spot this way, the greater the reward you deserve. Over a period of several weeks, your daily total of should statements will begin to go down, and you'll notice you're feeling less guilty. Another should removal technique zeroes in on the fact that you don't really trust yourself. You may believe that without all these should statements, you would just turn wild and go on a rampage of destruction, or murder, or even ice cream eating. A way to evaluate this is to ask yourself if there was any period in your life when you were particularly happy and felt reasonably fulfilled, productive, and under control. Think it over for a moment before you read on, and make sure you have a mental picture of this time. Now ask yourself, during that period in my life, was I whipping myself with a lot of should statements? I believe your answer will be no. Now tell me, were you doing all these wild, terrible things then? I think you'll realize you were should-free and under control. This is proof that you can lead a productive, happy life without all those shoulds. You can test this hypothesis with an experiment in the next couple of weeks. Try reducing your should statements using these various techniques, and then see what happens to your mood and self-control. I think you'll be pleased. Another method that you can fall back on is the obsessional filibuster technique described in Chapter 4. Schedule 2 minutes, 3 times a day, to recite all your should statements and self-persecutions out loud. I should have gone to the market before it closed, and I shouldn't have picked my nose at the country club, and I'm such a rotten bum, etc. Just rattle off all the most abusive self-criticisms you can think of. It might be especially helpful to write them down or dictate them into a tape recorder. Then read them later out loud or listen to the tape. I think this will help you see how ludicrous these statements are. Try to limit your shoulds to these scheduled periods so you won't be bothered by them at other times. Another technique to combat should statements involves getting in touch with the limits of your knowledge. When I was growing up, I often heard people say, "Learn to accept your limits and you'll become a happier person." But no one ever bothered to explain what this meant or how to go about doing it. Furthermore, it always sounded like a bit of a put-down, as if they were saying, "Learn what a second-rate dud you actually are." In reality, it's not as bad as all that. Suppose you frequently look into the past and mope about your mistakes. For example, as you review the financial section of the paper, you tell yourself, I shouldn't have bought that stock. It's gone down 2 points. As a way out of this trap, ask yourself, now, at the time I bought the stock, did I know it was going to go down in value? I suspect you'll say no. Now ask, if I'd known it was going down, would I have bought it? Again, you'll answer no. So what you're really saying is that if you'd known this at the time, you'd have acted differently. To do this, you would have to be able to predict the future with absolute certainty. Can you predict the future with absolute certainty? Again, your answer must be no. You have two options. You can either decide to accept yourself as an imperfect human being with limited knowledge and realize that you will at times make mistakes, or you can hate yourself for it. Another effective way to combat shoulds is to ask, why should I? Then you can challenge the evidence you come up with so as to expose the faulty logic. In this way, you can reduce your should statement to the level of absurdity. Suppose, for example, you hire someone to do some work for you. It could be lawn work, or a painting job, or anything. When he submits his bill, it seems higher than you understood it would be, but he gives you some fast talk, so you give in and end up paying his price. You feel taken advantage of. You begin to berate yourself for not acting more firmly. Let's do some role-playing, and you can pretend that you're the poor sucker who paid too much. You. Yesterday, I should have told that guy that his bill was too high.
David. You should have told him that he gave you a lower estimate?
Yeah, I should have been more assertive.
Why should you have? I agree that it would have been to your advantage to speak up for yourself.
You can work on developing your assertive skills so that in the future you'll do better in situations like that. But the point is, why should you have been more effective yesterday?
Well, because I'm always letting people take advantage of me.
Okay, let's think about your line of reasoning. Because I'm always letting people take advantage of me, I should have been more assertive yesterday. Now, what is the rational response to this? Is there anything about your statement that seems a little bit illogical? Is there anything fishy about your reasoning? Let me think. Well, in the first place, it's not exactly true that I'm always letting people take advantage of me. That would be an overgeneralization. I sometimes do get my way. In fact, I can be quite demanding at times. Furthermore, if it were true that I was always getting taken advantage of in certain situations, then it would follow that I should have behaved exactly as I did since this is my habit. Until I've mastered some new ways to deal with people, I'll probably continue to have this problem. Great. I couldn't have put it better. I see you've been absorbing what I've been telling you about should statements. I hope all my readers are as smart and attentive as you are. Are there any other reasons you think you should have behaved differently? Well, let me see. How about, I should have been more assertive because I wouldn't have had to pay more than I owed? Okay, now, what's the rational response to that? What is illogical about that argument? Well, since I'm human, I won't always do the right thing. Exactly. In fact, the following syllogism may help you. First premise, all human beings make mistakes, like sometimes paying too much. Do you agree with me so far?
Yes.
And what are you?
A human being.
And what follows?
I should make mistakes.
Right. That should be enough should removal techniques for you. Oops, I just did it myself. Let me say, it would be nice if you found those methods helpful. I think you'll find that by reducing this mental tyranny, you'll feel better because you won't be berating yourself. Instead of feeling guilty, you can use your energy to make necessary changes and enhance your self-control and productivity. 3. Learn to stick to your guns. One of the big disadvantages of being guilt-prone is that others can and will use this guilt to manipulate you. If you feel obligated to please everyone, your family and friends will be able to coerce you effectively into doing many things that may not be in your best self-interest. To cite a trivial example, how many social invitations have you half-heartedly accepted so as not to hurt someone's feelings? In this case, the price you pay for saying yes when you really would have preferred to say no is not great. You only end up wasting one evening. And there is a payoff. You will avoid feeling guilty. And you can fantasize that you are an especially nice person.
Furthermore, if you try to decline the invitation, the disappointed host may say, "But we are expecting you. Do you mean you are going to let the old gang down? Oh, come on." And then what would you say? How would you feel? Your obsession with pleasing others becomes more tragic when your decisions become so dominated by guilt that you end up trapped and miserable. The irony is that more often than not, the consequences of letting someone manipulate you with guilt end up being destructive, not only to you, but to the other person. Although your guilt-motivated actions are often based on your idealism, the inevitable effects of giving in turn out to be quite the opposite. For example, Margaret was a happily married 27-year-old woman whose obese brother, a gambler, tended to take advantage of her in a variety of ways. He borrowed money when he ran short and often forgot to repay it. When he was in town, often for several months at a time, he assumed it was his right to eat dinner with her family every night, to drink up the liquor, and to use her new car whenever he wanted. She rationalized giving in to his demands by saying, "If I asked him for a favor or needed his help, he'd do the same for me. After all, a loving brother and sister should help each other out. And besides, if I tried to say no to him, he'd explode, and I might lose him. Then I'd feel like I did something wrong." At the same time, she was able to see the negative consequences of continually giving in. One, she was supporting his dependent, self-defeating lifestyle and gambling addiction. Two, she felt trapped and taken advantage of. Three, the basis of the relationship was not love, but blackmail. She was constantly having to say yes to his demands to avoid the tyranny of his temper and her own sense of guilt. Margaret and I did some role-playing so she could learn to say no and stick to her guns in a tactful but firm manner. I played Margaret's role, and she pretended to be her brother. Brother, played by Margaret. "Are you using the car tonight?" Margaret, played by me. "I'm not planning to now." "Do you mind if I borrow it later?"
"I'd prefer that you don't."
"Why not? You're not going to use it. It'll just be sitting there."
"Do you feel I'm obliged to loan it to you?"
"Well, I'd do the same for you if I had a car and you needed it."
"I'm glad you feel that way. Although I'm not planning to use the car, I'd like to have it available in case I decide to go somewhere later on."
"But you're not planning to use it. Haven't we been brought up to help each other?"
"Yes, we have. Do you think that means I always have to say yes to you?"
"We both do a great deal for each other.
You have made a lot of use of my car, and from now on, I'd feel more comfortable if you'd begin to arrange your own transportation."
"I'm just planning to use it for an hour, so I get it back in case you need it. It's very important, and it's only a half mile away, so I won't wear your car out. Don't worry."
"It sounds like it is something important to you. Perhaps you can arrange some other transportation. Could you walk that distance?"
"Oh, that's fine. If that's how you feel, don't come to me for any favors."
"It sounds like you're pretty mad because I'm not doing what you want. Do you feel I'm always obliged to say yes?"
"You and your philosophy. Shove it. I refuse to listen to any more of this hogwash." Begins to storm off.
"Let's not talk about it any further then. Maybe in a couple of days you'll feel more like talking about it. I think we do need to talk things over."
After this dialogue, we reversed roles so that Margaret could practice being more assertive. When I played her brother's role, I gave her as tough a time as I could, and she learned how to handle me. This practice boosted her courage. She felt it was helpful to keep certain principles in mind when standing up to her brother's manipulations. These were, 1, she could remind him it was her right not to say yes to all his demands. 2, she could find a grain of truth in his arguments, the disarming technique, so as to take the wind out of his sails. But she could then come back to her position that love did not mean always giving in. 3, she was to adopt a strong, decisive, and uncompromising position as tactfully as possible. 4, she was not to buy into his role as a weak, inadequate little boy who couldn't stand on his own feet. 5, she was not to respond to his anger by getting angry herself, because this would reinforce his belief he was a victim who was being unjustly deprived by a cruel, selfish witch. 6, she had to risk the possibility he would temporarily withdraw and thwart her by refusing to talk to her or to consider her point of view. When he did this, she was to let him storm off, but she could let him know there were some things she wanted to talk over with him later on when he was more in the mood to communicate. When Margaret did confront him, she found he was not nearly as tough a customer as she imagined.
He actually seemed relieved and began to act more adult when she put some limits on the relationship. If you choose to apply this technique, you will have to be determined to stick to your guns because the other guy, or gal, may try to bluff you into believing that you're mortally wounding them by not giving in to their requests. Remember that the hurt you inflict in the long run by not following your best self-interest is usually far greater. Practicing ahead of time is the key to success. A friend will usually be happy to role-play with you and provide some useful feedback. If such a person is not available to you or you feel too shy to ask, write out an imaginary dialogue of the type illustrated.